You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with physicist Neil Johnson. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
It gets back to this core question. I'm so excited. Just wish I was a young scientist going into this. Why AI comes out with what it does? That's the burning question. It's bigger than the origin of the universe to me as a scientist. And here's the reason why. The origin of the universe, it happened. That's why we're here. It's almost like a historical question asking why it happened. The AI future is not a historical question. It's a now and future question. It's curious because I was always interested, like a lot of people, in, you know, what problems haven't been solved. But I was never very good at things like crosswords and these math puzzle type things. I was really more interested in the kind of messy real world problems. I always remember listening to the news a lot. I'm not sure that was good when I was growing up. You know, you hardly ever hear any of the good news. So I grew up in an era where there was just kind of two sides. It was always very much a discussion about stalemates and the kind of status quo of two objects. Fast forward, I start taking classes in school, of course, and kind of get interested in more math, science-y type things and end up in physics. Although I happen to do an undergraduate degree at Cambridge, which kind of dates back to the days of Newton, but was built around the idea that there's this natural world or the world that we want to understand and that maybe just one discipline isn't enough. And yet I fell into doing a PhD in physics, went to Harvard to do that. I've done an undergraduate degree, various disciplines mixed together, suggesting that problems need many disciplines to work together. And here I am spending what seemed like 50 years, but was only 5 years doing a PhD down some really narrow track. Just as I was printing out my PhD, I was thinking to myself, well, that was a waste of time. I know probably more about that tiny little project than anyone else in the world, and who cares? I started reading as I was printing out, because in those days, printers took a long time to print out. It's kind of reading about something called a Santa Fe Institute for Complex Systems, and these things were beginning to become the flavor of the future. I became a research fellow in Cambridge for a few years, and then a faculty member in physics at Oxford University, where again, I had to go straight down the line of this is physics, this isn't physics, therefore we don't touch it. But during that process, I started other projects. I've always been interested in the idea that messy problems then might have some kind of solution if you could get data on them. And so now we get into the kind of 2000s, the new millennium, where data's starting to become available. And that was a game changer. That launched me off into looking at all sorts of other disciplines, all sorts of other problems, messy problems, where you could get data. I'm more interested in other types of problems than something sitting at minus 273 degrees that I'll never even be able to see. There are lots of people who think about these problems, but the basic and the typical criticism of their work is that they treat objects as identical. So run fast forward to what I'm doing now and have been for quite a few years now is how do you do physics of objects that are not identical? On the one hand, it might sound kind of trivial because it's like, isn't that what particle physicists do? They try to find, yeah, but they're trying to do it one particle at a time. Nobody can explain why the Titanic went down one water molecule at a time, because it was the whole point. It was something emerged out of all of these water molecules in the sea at that time to do with the temperature and all these other things. Some ice had broken off. It still hadn't melted. And it happened to be in the same position as a ship at the time. All of those factors went together, and that none of that explanation comes from a simple assumption of particles being identical in all. So the idea that there's heterogeneity, which is the core idea of all the social sciences, the idea that you could bring that into physics, it's new. All the assumptions physicists make, it's because the particles can be treated as identical. But doing so brings you to conclusions that don't correspond to the messy real world when you look at these other application areas. So we're still in the process of generalizing that. Part of the creative process, in some sense, is learning how to interact with other disciplines. It's not something we're trained in, and it's not something that academia in general does. I happen to be a saxophone player, you know, try to be. Actually, these days, I just say I have a saxophone. But you think about something like music, it's not like everyone's a drummer or everyone's a guitarist or everyone's a saxophone player. Part of the richness comes from those different instruments, their shortcomings and advantages combined together to give the creative. My hope is that's what we end up doing in the academic field to try and address some of these messy problems. But the bottom line is a lot of patience, certainly some data. So instead of having cyclic arguments, you could say, well, in the end, that's what the data is. It doesn't matter what you think might happen. That's what happens. Certainly from our side, listening to the wealth of experience that comes from the other disciplines is it's so easy then to go straight to the spherical cow. It's so hard to know what you can assume is irrelevant background noise, like in music. What can I assume is just like the sound of a plane passing over? And what is my cue to start my solo? The world is not in equilibrium and probably will never be. In fact, if you look at creative processes, I'm sure it's true. I'm not an artist in any sense, but you know, people have, there's a bursty nature to life and to, and therefore the evolution of any system that you're trying to describe, there's a bursty nature. Now, what does that mean? Think of ourselves, you know, we go to sleep. We're not doing much while we're asleep. Then we wake up, then we might have a little bit of activity and then we may not, and then we have a bit more, and then we go to sleep. So it's an out of equilibrium kind of behavior during the day. And it turns out that in a deep level, when you look at all the data from financial markets, the creation of misinformation, you name it, there's bursty kind of activity in terms of its creativity of new content and promoting what's already there. And that is obvious to anyone outside of physics. It's very hard to describe that mathematically. It's much easier to describe things that are in equilibrium mathematically. So part of our challenge when dealing with things to do with, say, from misinformation is to try and describe that burstiness in the real world. It's almost like the heartbeat of these systems. How could you stop foreign influence? How could you stop misinformation? Most of the discussions, if you look at them, you know, the daily news, are to do with individual cases. There's this particular thing of misinformation, or these particular people were targeted. They are a tiny fraction of the entire population. Imagine one day you wake up and you find water in a pot is boiling. You want to describe it. You want to understand it. Why is water boiling? Imagine we didn't know that. And you go at it one molecule at a time, or two molecules at, well, this molecule is doing this and this molecule. It's all correct, but it's not giving you the big picture. What might you do at scale to stop it happening? And so all of our work, we don't want to just repeat what others are doing. All of our work is looking what happens at scale. What happens at scale is different from what might be happening in individual cases. Often when you read in media reports, et cetera, it sounds a bit chaotic because you hear this case, then you hear this case. There's a deep thing going on scientifically. For nothing to happen, we've probably all done this. You take milk, stick it in the fridge, too lazy to go to the grocery. So you just leave it there. After about 5 days, 10 days, you think, well, it's still okay. And then the 11th day, you go to pour it out and this big glob of curdled, basically the formation has started to form kind of quote unquote cheese. Oh no, the milk's gone bad. Why did that happen on the 11th day? You know, what was it, magic? No. What was happening was that you weren't noticing it. Every day you took it out. And all you could see was the macro level. You couldn't see the individual pieces of milk, the polymers. You couldn't see them beginning to aggregate together. So this is a new area of physics, the so-called dynamical phase transition. The mathematics of it is, as we showed in our paper, exactly the same as how shockwaves appear. So a shockwave is something that I think we can all imagine. I hear nothing. A plane's gone over, some supersonic plane. We don't have many of them now. Nothing. Bang. What is that bang? It's a wave that's kind of built up so quickly ahead of itself in a way that there's no kind of precursor. You can't see it coming. AI has appeared. It's always been there, but suddenly it appeared on the global scale. It suddenly had a jump in capability. Given that we've been mapping out kind of communities where hate, extremism are promoted, it's a pretty easy guess that they will want to use AI in some way in the future. After all, creating bad content is time intensive. They have to promote it. They have to push it. They create links and they do all these sorts of things. And they have to sleep and eat and all these kind of things. If I can use AI to do that, for me, I'll use it. Now we've got this kind of roadmap of where these communities are, how they're connected, and they are literally now connected one step away from the rest of us. I can get to that in a minute. What we wanted to look at is, well, what AI will they use? Where will they use it? When will they use it? And what can we do about it? And that was a recent paper we had out in PNAS Nexus, which provided an answer to those questions. So the first thing of what AI? Well, we hear a lot about what the latest AI can do. It's remarkable what it can do, but they don't need that. They just need something simple. When you look on social media, you're not seeing Shakespeare level text. It is pretty basic, errorful, bad grammar stuff. And basic AI is really good at producing that. GPT-2 can run on a laptop. In fact, you can probably get it on a phone now, and it can produce content 24/7. And we showed in our paper that it can produce content that is, to a human, even an expert, indistinguishable from the human-created content that is already there, the human-created hate, conspiracy, distrust, etc. content, the bad actor content. We looked at something called progress curves, which are the acceleration of technology. And we looked back in time as how people had used cyber attacks, how they'd progressed with the algorithm writing, how quickly they produced improvements. And we applied it to the current progress of GPT technology. And we found that pretty much this summer is like the time for fruition for being able to produce GPT running continually within each of these hate and extremism communities globally. Time will tell whether that prediction actually comes to be true. But that's what our analysis predicted mathematically. And then the final thing of what can be done about it. Well, if you know the structure, you know where something is, you've got a much better chance of being able to do something about it. And it turns out when we looked at the data, that's exactly what the online communities that promote hate and extremism do. They form into their communities, the communities connect to each other. But when moderators come or there's some kind of threat, they scatter. They break the links, they break the community. And so they get this kind of shattering. So you get what an anthropologist would call fusion of objects into some group. And then sudden, what they would call fission. Now, it turns out that fusion fission behavior is the central idea in anthropology of how societies develop, tribes, and then break, and et cetera, when under threat. And so this idea became the key to understanding how extremism operates at scale online. It doesn't matter what the extremism is. It's a collective human behavior. AI, although it will probably change the workplace in dramatic ways that even Bill Gates probably can't imagine, I see it as part of that process of climbing up, society climbing up its own mountain. It's a tool, and it could do wonders for so many areas of science, medicine. When the car came out, I think the ones that lost were the ones that just kept their horses. In the end, you could keep your horse and ignore the car because the car initially is a disaster and it breaks down and it can't go very fast. But you fast forward and it was the key to so many advances in society. So I think it's exactly the same as AI. I was my first generation going to college. So I didn't really know what education was all about, actually. I've had some very inspirational teachers and some very non-inspirational teachers, like everybody, I think. But there was one that stands out by miles. And that was a teacher I had in elementary school when I was 8. He was from Jamaica. He just arrived in England, got this job to teach 8-year-olds. I'm not sure that he'd actually taught before, thinking back, because it turns out he was a jazz musician. This is how my start of being a jazz musician started with him. Because in the mornings, you know, sometimes I can't remember any of elementary school, but I do remember being in his class and he would start off the day playing jazz. And he had a piano in there, I mean, some terrible out-of-tune piano. But anyway, he was playing this music and I've never heard this kind of thing. He was just completely inspirational because it turns out that, you know, I didn't go to a great school. It wasn't necessarily a great area of England. So he was also charged with teaching the math. So suddenly there's someone who probably wasn't a teacher and he's really just a pianist and he's teaching math as well. But he brought in some technique, which I still use to this day to multiply numbers together. And I've never seen it taught anywhere. I think the era of having to memorize things, you know, exams based on remembering 30 pages of a book or something like that are going to go by the wayside. I think we're going to turn into a very creative period where education, even at the elementary high school level, becomes creative rather than jumping through the hoops and remembering things. So you've got it all ahead of you. A great, great future in education that none of us actually had necessarily.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in the exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.